Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Norman Mueller. I represent Mr. Hilty. Let me talk first about the instructional error in this case. Mr. Hilty was charged with a violation of both 1B and 1H, the subsection of the sexual assault statute. 1H, which is the physically helpless portion of that statute, provides for the affirmative defense of consent. The defense counsel requested a theory of the case instruction, which encompassed that theory. It also encompassed other parts of the defense, a defense as to the other count charged. Defense counsel requested the affirmative defense instruction, the elemental instructions, which included the affirmative defense. Defense counsel requested a definition of consent from the statute, and defense counsel requested instruction which informed the jury that the prosecution had the burden of disproving an affirmative defense as it had the burden of proving the elements of the offense. All of those instructions were denied. Judge Enzer essentially said there's no evidence of consent, end of discussion. I'm not going to go any further. There's nothing more well established, I don't think, as a principle of Colorado law, that a defendant is entitled to a theory of the case instruction. And if the court doesn't like the theory of the case instruction, then the trial court has an obligation to work with counsel to come up with what is acceptable to the trial court.
Mr. Mueller, how does the Supreme Court opinion in the Platt case impact your argument?
Well, the Supreme Court's opinion in Platt recognizes that with regard to 1H, the physically helpless portion of the statute, a defendant is entitled to the affirmative defense of consent. I think Justice Ives, that case had to do with 1B and whether or not the issue in that case was whether under those particular facts, there was sufficient evidence for both subsections. There are differences in our case, which I will get to later in my argument. But what Justice Ives recognizes in the majority opinion is that, and she cites 1H, that is the section that provides for the affirmative defense of consent. And Justice Hobbs' dissent for the three dissenting justices is very strong in the point that that's what's the problem with the majority's decision, is they took away the affirmative defense of consent, which the defendant would have been entitled to under the physically helpless statute. So I think Platt, Your Honor, supports my argument, confirms that consent is a defense as to one of the charges in this case.
Can I ask you about a follow-up on that point?
Yes.
Looking at the elements of 1H, the prosecution has to prove that the defendant was aware that the victim's physical help of the victim's physical helplessness and aware that the victim did not consent. How does the prosecution prove that the defendant was aware that the victim did not consent without also proving that the victim did not consent?
Well, Your Honor, there, first of all, the element, the courts have held that this is where there's an explicit provision of consent as an affirmative defense. I will tell you, I have great problem with the line of cases that say you're not entitled to tell the jury that this is a defense. We'll use self-defense, for instance, as to reckless manslaughter as another example, or consent. Because if, say the line of cases, if you prove the elements of the offense, you necessarily disprove the affirmative defense. I think, in all honesty, that line of cases gives too much credit to a jury, making them almost lawyers. I think they need to be explicitly told.
But Platt reaffirms those line of cases with which you disagree, right?
Well, only as to 1B. It does not as to 1H. That was a case as to whether or not
the argument in Platt was this was, should have been charged as physically helpless. This should have been charged as 1H. I do not read the majority opinion as saying that that consent is not an affirmative defense. A defendant is not entitled to an affirmative defense of consent for a charge of 1H. It's dealing with 1B. And the problem here is that this jury was never told what is consent. It is an act, it is cooperation, an act or attitude. And the jury was never told that. That was a tendered instruction. The jury was never told also that the prosecution has the burden of proving the of disproving essentially the affirmative defense. So I think Platt says, and I think it reaffirms, that as to 1H, consent is, in fact, an affirmative defense.
Can I follow up with that, Mr. Mueller?
Yes.
Assuming we were to agree with you that the court should have given an instruction defining consent, would that have remedied the issue because of what Judge Navarro referred to as being an element of the offense?
Well, it would have gone, I think I would have had a harder time countering a harmless error argument, but I still think it is very crucial that a jury be told about the burden of proof. And I think when we have the legislature saying, as to this element, this is an affirmative defense, then that triggers the elemental instruction, which requires without the element, without the affirmative defense of consent, it requires the definition, and third, it requires that the jury be told about the prosecution's burden of proof with regard to an affirmative defense, just as they have the burden with regard to the elements. And in this case, the trial court simply said, there's no evidence of consent. And that's what the Attorney General's argument is. There's no evidence of consent. And this, by the way, also doesn't deal with the fact that the defendant is entitled to a theory of the case instruction, which encompasses his defense to both of the counts charged, something the trial court also denied. And
but sort of following up, if I may, on Judge Casebolt's question. So you're relying a lot, I understand why, on some of the language in Platt, which suggests that 1H does allow for the affirmative defense of consent. Now, Platt seems to rely for that notion on the case of Dunton, which was a 1995 Colorado Supreme Court case, which basically says that. But I noticed that Dunton is a little bit confusing because it also has a footnote discussing 1H. At that time it was 1E, but it's the same as 1H.
Okay.
And in that footnote, the Supreme Court notes that that subpart requires the defendant to be aware of the victim's helplessness and lack of consent. And the Supreme Court goes on to say that subpart, the same subpart we're talking about, H, requires proof of the victim's non-consent. So if that's required of the prosecution to prove the victim's non-consent, and the jury was instructed that the prosecution has the burden to be unreasonable about to prove all the elements of the offense, wouldn't the error that you're alleging be surely harmless given what the jury had to find in order to convict him of the offense?
Well, I disagree because, first of all, I also have to go back to the theory of the case instruction and the fact that a defendant is entitled to this. The courts have held consistently a trial court must give a theory of the case instruction. If it's requested, it was requested here. And I fall back on Justice Hobbs' dissent, which really discusses the 1H. And I don't think there's anything inconsistent with regard to that component of Justice Hobbs' dissent, which says 1H is an affirmative defense. That's what's wrong with the majority of the decision, he says, because it deprives the defendant of that affirmative defense. And Justice Hyde doesn't say anything in her majority opinion. Said, no, that isn't the case. As a matter of fact, she says that with regard to 1B, there is no consent affirmative defense as opposed to 1H. And I think she
if I'm remembering correctly, it doesn't go into any more discussion about that.
And I completely agree with your reading of the case. I'm trying to figure out whether, even if it's true that the defendant was entitled to an affirmative defense instruction, as you're arguing, and as maybe Platt suggests, would the error be harmless, given that the prosecution was required to prove that the victim did not consent as part of proving 1H?
Well, if you take that to its logical conclusion, then you just ignore the fact that there's an affirmative defense, and you write out of the statute that affirmative defense and what goes with it, which are the requirement that you instruct the jury that there is no affirmative defense, and the prosecution has the burden of disproving that. And I don't recall, I'm sorry, Your Honor, the footnote that you're discussing, but I'm sure you've described it accurately. And I think, well, I'll stop. I already criticized.
Thank you.
There was sufficient evidence to justify these instructions, and it gets into the whole problem we had with the lack of unanimity instruction, or in the alternative, a verdict form or interrogatory that would distinguish these acts, because this is a very unusual case with the mixture of these two charges and the three acts alleged, both the oral sex, the intercourse, and the attempted anal intercourse, which are the three acts. And we don't know what the jury convicted the defendant of. We don't know what they found, if they found unanimously as to one of those three acts. But the evidence of consent was absolutely there. Forget about the inconsistencies in ES's testimony about the amount of alcohol, time frame, was there flirtation, who went upstairs, whose idea was it. The fact is, she testified unequivocally that she was awake during the act of intercourse. She was awake during the act of attempted anal intercourse. We don't know, she didn't really describe whether or not there was sexual intrusion or sexual penetration. So as to that element, there's a very strong argument that that was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt under these charges. May have been sexual contact, may not have proven sexual assault. So that is the problem with the court not giving the unanimity instruction, or in the alternative, that would have been solved by having a special verdict or interrogatory form and saying, do you agree that acts 1, 2, or 3 were proven? Let me illustrate very quickly. I can't cite an unpublished opinion, so I'm going to make it a hypothetical. But there's a case where an alleged victim said she woke up and somebody was engaged in digital penetration. She thought it was her boyfriend. She said, stop. They stopped. She started to go back to sleep, and then she woke up and there was attempted oral intercourse. Again, she said oral sex. She said, stop, it stopped. Then she was awake when the third act occurred, and that was actual intercourse. She then discovered, this is not my boyfriend. I thought it was my boyfriend. It's not my boyfriend. There was a special interrogatory where the jury said, not guilt. We don't agree with Act 1. We don't agree with Act 2. This was a physically helpless situation. But we do agree that they proved Act 3. It was undisputed she was awake. That's what we have here. It is undisputed she was awake through what I'll call Acts 2 and Acts 3. It was disputed as to whether she was asleep as to Act 1. But there's no evidence that there's any difference in this case. There's no other evidence, there's no independent evidence that she was incapable of appraising her conduct, that she was cognitively impaired in any way. This is a case that should have been charged only as a physical helpless case, and as to that count, the defendant was entitled to these affirmative defense instructions. I'll reserve my last minute. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jonathan Farrow, Assistant Solicitor General, registration number 35754, on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to quote from the defendant's reply brief on page 1. arguing that there was sufficient evidence that the accuser was asleep and therefore was physically helpless, the state relies on only a portion of ES's direct testimony and ignores ES's crucial admissions that she was awake for most of the sexual activities she described. And I read that because I believe that it answers in many ways the unanimity concerns that Mr. Mueller was just arguing. It also answers a lot of the sufficiency arguments in this case. Essentially, the defendant is asking this court to sit as proverbial 13th juror and re-decide and re-weigh the evidence in this case. What portion of ESS direct testimony is the state relying on? A portion of it in which she clearly and unequivocally testified. She awoke to the defendant performing oral sex on her, penetrating her vagina with his tongue. That, at that moment that she woke up, sexual assault was complete. It was complete under section 1B, and it was complete under subsection 1H. She was asleep, necessarily, at the moment he inserted his tongue into her vagina. She then awoke. The assault was complete. And we can certainly talk about whether the vaginal penetration that occurred after she was awake, I won't contest that, she was awake, that was her testimony, whether that could also satisfy 1B and 1H, and I think certainly the argument can be made for that.
Once the argument is made at trial, though, Mr. Farrell, that any one of these three acts could constitute the crime, don't we have to look further than just that first act itself?
That's a good point. I would suggest first this framework, and that is a framework that Justice Coates presented in his concurrence. So before I would say yes, well, something has to happen. And a defendant below in this type of case is presented with a strategic choice. And the first thing that the defendant can do is say, I want a bill of particulars. I want to force the prosecution to make an election on which act they're going to proceed. I don't have to choose that if I'm the defense counsel. I can just keep silent, let the evidence play out. That's what happened here. But if that's what you choose to do, then your other recourse at that point, before this case goes to the jury, is to request a modified unanimity instruction. That didn't happen here either. So when you fail to request either your first or second options, then you have absolutely waived the opportunity now to complain and have an appellate court do exactly what you described in the case law. Now, with that said, I'll go ahead and move past the waiver issue that's presented in the brief, and that's really all that can be said about it. And that is, if you were to look at the evidence in this case, first of all, this is a single transaction. And we know from the Molina case in the Supreme Court from a few years ago that settled any doubt that there may have been about this issue. There were a long line of Court of Appeals cases which said it, and the Supreme Court has now confirmed it. When you have a single transaction, and there may be multiple acts within that transaction, doesn't matter. A defendant in that instance is not entitled to either an election or a modified unanimity instruction.
Can I interrupt you for a second, counsel? At trial, just following up on Judge Casebolt's question, did the prosecution rely on either the vaginal sex act or the attempted anal sex act in support of either of the counts, or did the prosecution rely entirely on the oral sex act when she was asleep?
My recollection, Judge Navarro, is that the prosecution argued that either the oral sex or the vaginal penetration would support or both, and, you know, it was one of those types of things.
Okay, as to the vaginal penetration, how was or elements satisfied as for 1B or 1H? How was she either physically helpless or incapable of praising her own conduct when you concede she was awake during those?
Well, and the way I would preface my answer first is, before we answer this question today, and I mean, I believe that there is an answer to the evidence is sufficient for that. The jury could have found exactly that. But the preface to that question is, would this court hold as a matter of law on this evidence that should not have gone to the jury? I mean, that's essentially what you would be holding if you said the evidence was insufficient. So keep that in mind, because this is really a factual question. And what were those facts? Well, we had a lot of statements by the victim in this case. We had statements that were made to an initial intake police officer. We have statements that were then made to a detective that specialized in sexual assault investigations. We had statements that were made to a nurse investigator that performed a physical exam. And then, of course, we had the actual testimony at trial. So there were a lot of different statements. And you put all of this together, and there's a lot of different funds of evidence from that. But they all came from the same source, which is the victim. And what did she say? Well, about that particular moment when she awoke, She testified, try to, I don't know, pretend it was a dream and go back to sleep or ignore it, and it's not actually happening. I don't know. I just really don't know what, didn't know what to do. And then when the defendant attempted anal penetration, she said, I kind of freaked out. There were a lot of, those were the direct kind of non-leading answers, but there were also some leading questions as well that she affirmed, such as you were in a total state of shock when you first woke up. I think that the evidence in this case could support the inference that at the first possible instance that she truly was, under subsection H, the language is, the definition of physically helpless, I'm sorry, where she was first able to speak up and indicate willingness, that happened. She did it when she was first able, and that was when the anal...
So you're saying when she was awake and she didn't know what was happening, or she was scared, that qualifies as being physically helpless?
She was in a state of semi-sleep, and the Platt case acknowledges that there's a continuum. This is in the Court of Appeals opinion that Judge Sternberg authored. It was not divided in this court, by the way. It was divided, but that doesn't matter, at the Supreme Court. But in the Court of Appeals decision, you'll see a citation to a case from the Second Circuit, which talks about awake to sleep. It's a continuum. It's not a hard line. There's a state in between, and that really is why. What underlies the reasoning of the Platt decision in this court and the Platt decision as affirmed in the Supreme Court? Because when you're in that state of both being asleep and then starting to wake up, it can fit. It can fit under physically helplessness. It's a factual question for the jury, and it's probably submitted there.
Yeah, I guess I didn't understand the record to, or her testimony to say that she was in a state of semi-sleep during the bad anal sex act. I thought she was fully awake by that point, so that Platt wouldn't, or that the case that you just discussed would not apply to that scenario.
And I would disagree to the extent to say, did she use that magic word? Did she say, I was in a state of semi-sleep? No. Did she say, I was fully awake? Did she say it exactly like that? No. It's a question for the jury. And what is the exact phrase that Platt uses from the Supreme Court? A sufficient state of sleep, unquote, so as to be incapable of apprising the nature of conduct. Well, how sufficient of a state of sleep was she in? That is a factual question for the jury, not a legal question. Now, moving further, we were talking a bit about unanimity, and I'd like to compare two cases to talk about the single transaction question. Because really, this isn't close. The defense relies on the Childress case in their reply brief. Childress was a child abuse case. And just to present a portion of that, this is from the published opinion in that case, and this is from 2012. The jury had before it extensive evidence of child abuse. The prosecution presented evidence that defendant took the victim to a party where underage drinking and drug use was occurring, forced the victim to drink alcohol, placed the victim in a dryer and closed the door, took the victim out in the cold without proper clothing. Oh, and then it goes on. The jury also heard testimony about different car trips that night, and it goes on and on and on. So I think you can see my point. That case really is way beyond what could be a very discreet single transaction. Wherever you would draw that line, here in contrast, what we had three different types of sexual penetration that occurred within a span of minutes. We had penetration by the tongue, penetration by the penis, and then an attempted anal penetration, or perhaps I should add, the evidence is there was a shred of evidence at trial that it was actual anal penetration. That was a statement of the victim to the same nurse investigator who was presented to the jury. So we have those three activities, even if you count the third one. They all took place within a span of minutes, on the same bed, in the same room, all under the same circumstances. Was there a pause? Was there a stop and start? Oh, I'm going to go take a shower. Defendant then comes back and assaults again? No. This is a single transaction.
Well, can we move from there, Mr. Farrow, to the issue of the affirmative defense instruction? Because
absolutely.
It seems to me that if the unanimity, if we say you don't need a unanimity instruction on plain error review, you still have to deal with the instructional issues, do you not?
Sure. And just to answer that, Your Honor, first of all, I think there's a lot of confusion. And that discussion that Judge Navarro, that you're having with Mr. Mueller really highlights the distinction between what is called an affirmative defense, it's the term of art, and a traverse. And I was looking through the Platt opinion again as during that portion of the argument. I don't see the word affirmative in there anywhere. I see the phrase defense of consent and a consent defense.
But the statute specifically says it's an affirmative defense.
It doesn't say that, Your Honor.
The statute, not the one that's in the provision dealing with that offense, but the general consent statute says if consent is a defense, it is an affirmative defense, does it not?
Are you talking about the definition of consent?
Yes.
It doesn't say it shall be an affirmative defense to my knowledge. I could be mistaken on that. But it states in subsection H that it is an element.
Okay. I thought from reviewing Justice Hobbs' dissent, he cites to several different statutes, one of which is the general provision applicable to offenses, as opposed to the consent issue in this particular
right.
statute?
And I'm looking at both the elements of this statute as well as the definition of consent in the sexual assault statute.
Okay.
Well, which is 18.3.4.1.1.5.
Okay.
I think that's where it would be.
I think there's another statute, but I'll digress on that for a moment. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that consent is not an affirmative defense.
Mm-hmm. In that case, it's simply a traverse because it negates the elements.
But it is a traverse. Is he not entitled to a theory of the case instruction based on
that? A theory of the case instruction, generally, yes, there's a general entitlement that you should be able to present your defense. But here's what happened in this case. And again, I'm going to go back to the reply brief because this really summarizes, and I'm not saying it's a concession, but it really summarizes what the trial court concluded. And on page 8 and 9, while it is true that E.S. denied consenting to the sexual activity during her testimony, the following facts and reasonable inferences from those facts established a basis for the jury to conclude that the prosecution had not sustained its burden of disproving consent. That's all the theory of the case instruction that defense counsel presented was. It was an instruction saying prosecution didn't meet their burden, did not meet their burden. You're not entitled to that as an additional instruction. It's not even a denial. You're just saying that they didn't meet their burden. Well, that's encompassed by all the other instructions. The jury was clearly instructed on what the prosecution's burden was. They were instructed that they couldn't find the defendant guilty if that burden was not met beyond a reasonable doubt. So that instruction, as presented, was superfluous, and it was not required.
Is that the reason the trial court gave for not giving the instruction?
The trial court expressly found, actually, that there was no evidence of consent presented.
So the trial court gave a different reason than you presented.
Sure, and I'm not allowed to argue any reason whatsoever support under the evidence case.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify what the record was.
No, and you're correct about that. And I think what the trial court was trying, what the trial court was saying, though, is, look, all you're really saying is that the prosecution didn't meet its burden. You haven't presented any evidence that this was consensual. All you've done is try to raise some innuendos, some speculation, some reverse inferences that they didn't meet their burden of showing that it was non-consensual. And that, to me, that's what the judge is saying. That's not enough. You know, we had statements by the defendant in this case. It came in from a pretextual phone call. If the defendant had once in that phone call said, you consented, this is what you wanted, we agreed on this, whatever, you get the gist. Fine, I just wanted to say that because I don't want to present to the court any notion that he was required to take the stand. Because there could have been a statement, there just wasn't. That wasn't the evidence in this case. There was not even a denial. It was, I don't remember what happened. I'm so sorry. I don't know. Your memory's better than mine, that type of stuff.
So just to be clear, what your view of the Platt case is that it doesn't require an affirmative instruction or affirmative defense of consent. Is that what you're saying? But
yes.
It does allow the defendant to argue that the victim consented. I'm trying to figure
absolutely.
Out
absolutely.
How defendants are supposed to deal with Platt or how trial courts are supposed to deal with it.
Exactly as the trial court here allowed them to do. The defense counsel argued in both opening and closing. And by the way, the closing in this case took place after the instructional argument, for what that's worth. But the defense counsel was allowed to argue consent in both of those arguments and presented, if you read the cross-examination of the victim in this case, I mean, the cross-examination was extensive. And it went on and on and on in excruciating detail about various inconsistencies in her testimony for the jury to weigh. and they admitted the jeans she was wearing so the jury could look at those. Were they slim jeans? Could they possibly have been pulled off while she was asleep and she wouldn't wake up? The jury got to decide all of that, and all of that was argued and presented in evidence. And that's exactly how it should proceed. See, my time has expired. Unless the court has further questions, thank you for your time today, and I would ask that the convictions below be affirmed.
Thank you.
Just briefly, Judge Navarro, the district attorney relied on all the elements, all the acts in trying to prove the guilt of Mr. Hilty. Judge Casebolt, I think the statute you were referring to is 18.1.505.1, which is what Justice Hobbs referred to when he says consent should have been raised as an affirmative defense. Platt was not allowed to raise it, so I think that's the statute. I don't have my statute book with me to double check that. And just finally, with regard to consent and being awake, this was a combined offense. She was not physically helpless. She could certainly apprise the nature of her conduct. She wasn't cognitively impaired. And much of that defense rested on the fact that she admitted she was awake. She admitted she was awake for up to 5 minutes through oral sex. And then, based on her description of positions, there had to be a change in position, and then 5 to 10 minutes of attempted, 5 to 10 minutes of intercourse. And then she said, when he attempted anal intercourse, that's when I decided I wanted it to stop. And nothing had prevented her, and she admitted nothing prevented her from stopping it early. And that's why the jury never got to hear a consent defense and didn't get to have the instructions of a consent defense. And that is part of the error, and it makes it very hard to evaluate all the sufficiency because we don't know what the jury found because there was no unanimity or special interrogatory. I'm out of time.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.